Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And welcome into the Steve Jones Show, Tuesday, August 14th on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Driven by Sunbury Motors, Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai, North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia on the Strip, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sean Carey here as we continue our best of week. Although Steve does not have the day off today. Tonight, in-state college at Medler Field at Lebrano Park, it is the New York Penn League All-Star Game. Steve will be calling that on the TV side of things this evening. And Sunbury native Nick Dunn will get some playing time tonight in the All-Star Game. So congratulations to Nick so far on the professional portion of his baseball career. Steve's back with us live next week on Monday. Of course, we'll get full bore into football. We will have some football conversation coming up in the next half hour. We'll do a replay with USA Today college football writer Paul Meyerberg. And also next hour, one of the greats from Linebacker U, Penn State linebacker, now with the Oakland Raiders, Jason Cabinda. We will replay Steve's interview with Jason at 4:06. One of Jack Ham's teammates, Steve Smear. We'll have a replay from the fall of 2016 on tomorrow's show. Look forward to that. As well as Phil Savage, the former color analyst for the Alabama Football Radio Network. We'll talk about Phil's new business venture in, well, no longer college football, but pro football. And we'll definitely have some pro football talk coming up on Friday. I'll have a replay with Adam Kaplan from Sirius NFL, Sirius XM NFL Radio, and Sporting News national college football writer Bill Bender. So we'll have that on Friday's show. A no show on Thursday because of the Phillies. Phillies will be starting a five-game series with the Mets on Thursday, which is a doubleheader, which, of course, will wrap up on Sunday with the second annual Major League Baseball Little League Classic from Bowman Field, Sunday night at 7. And, of course, we'll have that for you here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. But before the series with the Mets, you got the Phillies meeting up again with the best team in baseball. Second time in 2 weeks, Phillies and Red Sox. Two-game set starts tonight. Nick Pivetta of the Phillies will face Boston's Rick Porcello. 14-5, Pivetta is 7-9. Phillies continue to battle the Braves for first in the National League East. They return home after a 2-4 road trip, which featured a series loss to the Arizona Diamondbacks and the San Diego Padres. Some felt that Sunday's 9-3 loss to the Padres, one of the worst losses of the season. But the Phillies have won 6 games in a row at home. The Red Sox are 85-35. They have won 4 in a row, 10 of their last 11 in August. So it's business as usual for the Bo Sox, which moved to a season-best 50 games above 500 with a 4-1 win over Baltimore on Sunday. Red Sox and Phillies split a 2-game series in Boston at the end of July. Phillies pitchers held the normally potent Red Sox offense to 3 runs in the 2 games in Fenway Park. Pivetta will try for similar success tonight. We do have the lineup in for the Phillies this evening. It is Hernandez, Williams, Cabrera, Hoskins, Santana, Franco, Odubel Herrera, Alfaro, and Pivetta. He'll be your starting 9 tonight for the Phillies. Yes, Carlos Santana out of the cleanup spot. He has moved down to 5. Rhys Hoskins batting cleanup tonight for the Fightins. The Phillies did make a move today. They have recalled right-handed pitcher Hector Neris from Lehigh Valley. And to make room on the 25-man roster, infielder J.P. Crawford was optioned to Lehigh Valley yesterday. So I'll have that for you tonight from Citizens Bank Park. First pitch, 7:05, we'll have on deck with J.J. Jim Jackson at 6:30, followed by the call with Scott Fransky and Larry Anderson. College football news that has broken within the past hour from the University of Maryland. Their president, Dr. Wallace Lowe, and athletic director Damon Evans have taken responsibility for the June death of offensive lineman 19-year-old Jordan McNair. Press conference was held a little over an hour ago in College Park. However, the university has not yet made a decision regarding the status of football coach DJ Durkin, who remains on administrative leave. Lowe said that the university accepts legal and moral responsibility for the mistakes that were made on that fateful workout day on May the 29th. Referring to the day that McNair suffered heat stroke at practice and was admitted to the hospital. Dr. Lowe went on to say that he personally acknowledged and apologized to McNair's family earlier in the day in Baltimore. He says these are allegations that we have to take very, very seriously, so what fair process demands is that we do a thorough investigation by an independent group and make the recommendations, and we'll implement those recommendations, and we will monitor the continued implementation of those recommendations. An investigation into McNair's death as well as the culture of the program will be released publicly sometime in mid-September. The safety and well-being of our student-athletes is our highest priority. And that was a quote from the Maryland Athletic Director Damon Evans last weekend. These alleged behaviors are not consistent with the values I expect all of our staff to adhere to, and we must do better. Also in that press conference, it was announced that Maryland has fired strength and conditioning coach Rick Court. But DJ Durkin continues to stay on administrative leave. More on that when we get further developments in on the situation at the University of Maryland and their football program. So now you got two coaches, DJ Durkin and Urban Meyer, on administrative leave, and both of them in the same division as Penn State. You can get in touch with us anytime. Our email, stevejones@wkok.com. Don't forget our Facebook page. Give us a like. We're on Twitter, too. Give us a follow. Twitter follow. Our Twitter handle is stevejonespsu, @stevejonespsu. And you can always get access on demand to our Steve Jones Show podcast. You can subscribe on the Apple Podcast app, iTunes, or Google Play. Just search Steve Jones Show. And also, you have access to 3 months of shows. We've got them archived on our homepage at stevejonesshow.com. All right, so we will continue the focus on college football. And just talking about Maryland a second ago, it's one of the newer schools in the Big Ten Conference, Maryland and Rutgers. And we had a discussion here on the show about a month or so ago about schools in Power 5 conferences that feel left out in their own leagues and conferences.
But I think, Sean, I think that's a fair evaluation over the years of what I've experienced is, and this goes back to Maryland. Maryland's now going into their fifth year. The fans down there, they want to be in the ACC. That's what they're used to.
I mean, I'll admit, in the 90s, when they made their debut in the Big Ten, it took a while to settle in and get used to, but it was hard when you already had that already ingrained and locked in rivalry in place between Ohio State and Michigan. And, you know, of course, people out there say it is the greatest rivalry in college football or in all of sports. And I think that's kind of the thing with Penn State playing Ohio State and Michigan every single year. We consider both of them very huge games. But when you talk to the fan bases of both of those colleges, no, our big game is when we play Michigan or when we play Michigan or when we play Ohio State. If you talk to either one of those fans from either one of those schools.
Yeah, you know what? I did see something, though, when I went to the Penn State and broadcast the Penn State-Ohio State game last year. And when they stormed the field after the game, it was a dramatic come-from-behind win. I got it. You know, it was. But their fans stormed the field. Like, it meant something. I mean, like, it meant something to them. And here's the other element. Penn State beat Ohio State 2 years ago here. Dramatic close game. Ohio State needed a dramatic close game to then reciprocate and win at home. Michigan's won one time in the last, 13 years against Ohio State. When does it stop being a rivalry? I mean, when one team is that dominant and keeps winning all the time, when does it start to lose its juice? But again, if you're an older Penn State fan, I mean, look, I run into this all the time. The Big Ten bugs them in some ways. Now do you expect Maryland, after, you know, the big game for them was always, hey, let's play Duke? I mean, Duke basketball. What's interesting about Maryland is this. Maryland's biggest game basketball-wise was always when they played Duke at home. The problem Maryland had was is that for Duke, it was just another game. I think Duke's big rival's North Carolina. 8 miles apart, the whole deal, long history. Now they have a long history with Maryland. But again, for Maryland, the biggest game they played all year was against Duke. For Duke, it was another game in the ACC. Now, they're good, they're good. If Maryland was really, really good, then obviously you throw more juice on it. Whomever's good at the moment is where your juice goes. So when I was had a chance to talk to Jesse earlier, that is that's one of the topics. And again, I brought it up with Derek Williams. He goes, nah, it's just really not catching on here. And I've talked to Johnny Holiday about this many, many times. Yeah, I mean, John will tell you the same thing. I completely understand him. Penn State's in the same conference, for example, with Illinois. But, I mean, does anybody out there go, oh, Illinois, here they come? It's like, okay. They want you to win that week because it's that week.
What were your thoughts several years ago when that land-grant trophy was developed and they were trying to get a rivalry going with Michigan State? Blocked in, always the final game of the regular season.
I understood what they were trying to do, so I understood it. And it was George Perlis's idea. You know, he's the one that called up Joe and he said, hey, you know, let's do this. Because Michigan State was already locked out of playing Michigan in the last game of the season. So they're already locked out of it. You know, remember, Perlis also, too, coached for years with the Steelers. So it wasn't like he was unfamiliar with Penn State. So he wanted to try and do this at the end of the season, thinking it would be good for both schools to do it because there's no way Penn State could play either Michigan or Ohio State at the end of the year. There's no way Michigan State can play Ohio State or Michigan at the end of the year. So he thought, okay, well, let's, you know, we can do it. So I thought that was fine. The trophy's absurd. It takes four people to carry that. Do you know that?
Does look kind of heavy.
Kind of. It takes four. First of all, it's whomever designed it missed the mark. That's a very kind. It's a kind way of saying it, don't you think?
Yeah, it's also really not all that aerodynamic.
Oh,
it's quite the doorstop, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But just with all the other trophies that have been within the Big Ten for years and years, you know, the Oaken Bucket, you know, you know, the Axe, you know,
Penn State's got the victory bell with Minnesota.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I'm not big on the trophy games. Never have been. You want to know why? Let's go back to Ohio State and Michigan. What trophy do they play for?
Last I checked, they don't have one.
They don't. Okay, it's who wins the game. To me, the trophy is lifting up a Big Ten Championship trophy, a Big Ten East trophy, a Rose Bowl or Fiesta Bowl trophy, and obviously a college football playoff trophy. Now, those are the trophies you want to lift up. Not the fact that, hey, I got the victory bell. We beat Minnesota. Okay, let's hug each other. Let's move on. Okay, you know, and that's about where it is. Those games don't mean... Now, you know me, I approach every game the same anyway. I mean, I always get, like, how much more... Like, I put exactly the same amount of work into Illinois as I do into Ohio State. I'm also, you know, I'm not dumb. I'm smart enough to know the stakes of the game. But when Penn State plays Illinois, you can't have the proper stakes to the Ohio State game unless you beat Illinois. So it's an important game. Because that's, you know, again, the old saying, that's the only one in front of you that week. But, again, that's the point I made about the Big Ten over and over again, is in part because Ohio State and Michigan, the other eight schools were mediocre to poor in football for a long time. In fact, in the 70s and in the 80s, Penn State would have dominated the Big Ten. Penn State was better. In the 80s, I mean, you're going to tell me Michigan and Ohio State were better than Penn State? In the 80s? Are you kidding me? No. Penn State played for the national championship three times in the decade. And unlike Ohio State and Michigan during that era, won. Bowl games? Bowl games. You know how far under 500 Bo Schembechler is in bowl games? And Bo's a great coach, by the way. But you know how far under 500 he is? You realize Ohio, that Woody Hayes was under 500 in bowl games at Ohio State? Now, Woody Hayes is at 500 because he won a salad bowl, I'm not joking, at Miami, Ohio. So I think he's 6-6 like that. But he was 5-6 in bowl games at Ohio State. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this. If you actually sit down and read it, you're realizing that the two of them played 10 games, blah, 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 finally got to the last game, and that was the last game was the last game because they're the only two decent teams in the league at that time. Well, now look at the league. Ohio State's terrific. Wisconsin's really good. Michigan State's come back, and they're good. Michigan's good. Penn State's terrific. Plus, you've got some other teams like Northwestern and, you know, and so forth that can really play. The conference has never been deeper than it is now. When Ohio State and Michigan were carving out these great years and they got to play the game at the end of the season, the Big Ten was absolutely mediocre 3 through 10. Mediocre 3 through 10. And then when they finally got the bowl games and had to, quote, play somebody else, forget it.
Okay. Here's a two-pronged trivia question for you. How many undefeated, untied seasons did Woody Hayes have in his career? How many undefeated, untied seasons did Woody Hayes have in his career? Two. That's it. How many undefeated, untied seasons did Bo Schembechler have in his career? None. How about that? I mentioned Woody Hayes at Ohio State was 5-6 in bowl games. Bo Schembechler was 5-12. So between the two of them, carrying the Big Ten banner, they were 10-18 in bowl games when they finally stepped outside and had to play somebody else. I think that's what bothers Penn State fans a lot, that the two, Woody Hayes and Bo Schembechler, are justifiably honored in the Big Ten. Justifiably. They did a lot for the conference, and they were great coaches. But they didn't have the record that somebody else had.
Nobody likes road work. And we've seen a lot of it this summer.
And there's more.
Roadwork is scheduled for North 4th Street in Sunbury on the 16th.
So now
is the time to get to Sunbury Motors Ford before the roadwork begins. SMC is on a mission to sell 50 vehicles in just 5 days.
Before the roadwork starts.
Save up to a whopping $16,200 on the area's largest selection of new 2018 Ford trucks. Choose from over 80 trucks with new 2018 Ford F-150s slash to as low as $25,995. Pick from 56 2018 Ford Escapes, priced as low as $18,820. And there's 0% financing for up to 72 months, plus discounts as high as $5,000 on many new Fords. SMC has 21 2018 Ford Focuses, starting at $14,925. SMC is on a mission to sell 50 vehicles before the North 4th Street road work begins. Sunbury Motors Ford in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sean Carey here for Steve. It is best of week, and Steve busy tonight. He'll be calling the New York Penn League All-Star Game in State College at Medlar Field at Lebrano Park. And former Shikellamy baseball star and Former Maryland star Nick Dunn be your leadoff hitter tonight for the South All-Stars. He is the only State College Spikes player to get in the starting lineup tonight for the South. So congratulations to Nick. Off to a great start so far in his professional baseball career. So that'll be tonight in State College. And we just posted a picture of the starting lineup on our WKOK Facebook page with Nick there at the top. So way to go, Nick. So our best of week continues. By the way, no show on Thursday because of a Phillies-Mets doubleheader. That'll be the start of a five-game weekend series for the Fightins and the Mets, which will culminate on Sunday night at historic Bowman Field for the Major League Baseball Little League Classic. Phillies-Mets will have it for you here on WKOK. Of course, tonight we will have coverage of the first of the two-game series between the Phillies and the Boston Red Sox from Citizens Bank Park. On Deck will start at 6:30 and first pitch at 7:05 with Scott Fransky, Jim Jackson, and Larry Anderson. So the big story from earlier this afternoon, Maryland holding their press conference at College Park. DJ Durkin remains on administrative leave, and the university has fired strength and conditioning coach Rick Court. More information on that story as it continues to develop. So a little over a month ago, had some great college football conversation with Steve and the national college football writer from USA Today making his debut appearance on the show, Paul Meyerberg.
Paul Meyerberg, college football writer, USA Today, joins us. Hi, Paul. Welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Yeah, great to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
All right, let's start with this. The Big Ten athletic directors got together, and when they did, they went through a usual variety of topics, but Sportsbook brings a new angle to everything in sports, and they at least sent a proposal to the NCAA loosely about, hey, look, maybe we should consider universal injury reports. When you saw that, what ran through your mind, and what kind of model should they look at, the NFL or something else?
Well, the first thought, obviously, is that this is a good idea. I mean, it's a good idea on a number of different levels, but even if you just look at it through a gambling lens, I think it's important for the NCAA and certainly for its institutions to be at the forefront, and not necessarily in terms of condoning necessarily or even adopting their own rules and regulations regarding how or whether you can gamble on college sports, but just necessarily to align themselves into a position where the NCAA can make money on it, because that's what the NCAA does. That's all they really exist for. That's to make money for their member institutions. So I think an injury report is almost too logical to consider as you kind of envision a near future where college football gambling is prevalent in most states more often than not. But on a more game day level, what I thought about was, you know, this kind of evens the playing field, because that as it is, you have programs who don't even issue a depth chart like Michigan, then you have programs like Northwestern that actually send out an injury report every Thursday. So I just thought that immediately it would even the playing field, make things more consistent, and also fit into the gambling theme. And yeah, I do think the NFL model would work best, which I believe on Fridays you get the final list of who's out and who's doubtful and who's, you know, projected to play.
When you saw Sportsbook to be expanded, right now you've got New Jersey, Delaware. They're in now, as is obviously Nevada's been there for a long time. There could be, it's been 5 years, as many as 30 states doing this. In terms of the optics of integrity of the game, is an injury report a step in optics toward integrity?
I would think so. I mean, integrity-wise, I think the best thing the NCAA needs to do is really address the amateur model. And obviously that's the elephant in the room for the NCAA in terms of whether you pay players in general, this kind of lump sum, whether you allow name and likeness. I think that's the biggest step they'll take towards maintaining the integrity while also adopting and adapting to kind of a new culture we live in, a new society surrounding sports. But it would help. I mean, it is something that I'm not sure why college coaches or programs really feel the need to play this close to the vest, whether it's gamesmanship or something else. I just feel being open, talking about injuries is important for the sport in terms of player safety. It's a topic that we need to talk about in the media and also coaches. And just in general, being open about injuries is a good step towards making just injuries in general something that's, you know, we consider more often in sports, especially this sport, because it is important to consider.
You mentioned Jim Harbaugh. He went through the NFL and had to report injuries every day all the time with the 49ers. Are you surprised with the tact he's taken in Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised to a degree because it's so much worse and so beyond what you're seeing from other people. But knowing his personality a little bit, as we all tend to do, I mean, it's not surprising. I would think that Jim Harbaugh looks for every potential angle or, you know, avenue that he can take to get even the slightest advantage for his team. He must think this is one. But, you know, they went 8-5 last year, so he might want to try something.
Yeah, you might want to try something. The new rules this year, one of them is you can play up to four games, and it could be a combination of any four games and still maintain that year of eligibility. What were your thoughts when you saw that happen?
Well, another move that, you know, benefits two groups, and I think it benefits coaches, and you wouldn't think it does, but it does benefit coaches to a significant degree, and that's the ability to evaluate their true freshmen, to get a good look at them, to get an idea of where they are in their process or in their progress as players, and also just get guys experience for your system. You know, you can practice that whole redshirt year and run routes on a practice field on Tuesdays, but it's totally different to do it on a Saturday. So it will help guys acclimate to the game. That's good for programs, good for coaches. But obviously for players as well, you know, you get to miss that redshirt season. You get to, you know, not feel like you're not a part of the team. You start your clock, you get a little more experience. It's good for everybody. Again, and not to be a cynic about it and be jaded, but we do talk a lot about player safety. That's an extra four games on a student-athlete's body. That may be something that could be an issue or could be a topic that people want to address, but in general, I thought it was a positive move, a good rule change for everybody.
Does it put potentially some extra juice into the bowl season? Because every once in a while, a veteran like a Leonard Fournette or a Christian McCaffrey will forego the bowl game to get ready for the draft. Does it put potentially more juice into a bowl game if you have a series of guys that have played three games and that fourth one would be the bowl game?
Yeah, for sure. And that's really fascinating. What's also interesting to think about is, like, what about the other three games, right? Let's say you're Ohio State or you're Penn State, and you have a top five recruiting class coming in. No matter what, even if you've got great depth, you're going to play 10 to 12 of them just because they're too good to keep off the field. What about those other 10 guys or those other 8 guys that you would have played in another environment? What if when Penn State plays Ohio State or Penn State plays Michigan, you can roll out 6 of those guys, and they'll help you on special teams, they'll be there for depth, they'll return a kick, they'll do whatever. They'll be ready for a certain package. That's a major advantage. So for schools like Penn State, Ohio State, that recruit at a high level, you know, your USC, whomever, it's a real advantage just for the game that you need them for. And certainly bowls would be one of them. I didn't think about the fact that you could replace your outgoing NFL guy, but that's a really good point. You know, when you lose a McCaffrey or a Fournette, or one day you're going to lose a QB going into a bowl game, maybe you have a guy that you can plug into play, and it's not, you know, the Rose Bowl. It's a Citrus Bowl, and you roll with the punches knowing that the experience will help them out next season.
The transfer rule, now, again, and this is not a let's hit a Jim Harbaugh thing. I mean, let's face it, that's the area with him I've been most surprised at, that he hasn't been able to recruit and groom a quarterback. He's been able to exist on transfers. Rudock, Okorn, of course, from Houston didn't really pan out too well, but now he's got Shea Patterson. You and I both know, Paul, that when it comes to college basketball, there's 700 to 800 transfers a year. It's like the waiver wire in April and May. The new transfer rule says they can just walk in and say, look, I'd like a transfer, and within 48 hours, beginning October 15th, they have to be put on the list in the database. What did you think of that?
Now, transfers are a major topic among coaches. I mean, I've heard coaches call them things like an epidemic because transfers are rising so much. I wrote a story a couple weeks ago about the kind of death of the career backup quarterback in college, and there's only 7 senior QBs in Division I FBS who are seniors, who are on scholarship and haven't transferred despite not starting a game. You know, there's no guy who just stays for 3 or 4 years and sticks around. So it's an issue. But I do think this kind of an issue in the sense that it does impact programs. What I'm interested in thinking about moving forward with the new transfer rule is, will it really lead to an uptick and this great increase in transfers? I'm not totally sold that it will. I mean, people could always have transferred before, and if you had the opportunity, just because you couldn't transfer from Alabama to Georgia doesn't mean that you couldn't transfer and play somewhere else. So I don't think it'll lead to a rise in transfers. I think it will make things easier for everybody. So I think that schools such as, you know, in the SEC most of all, but even in other conferences, it makes things ugly, and it makes things difficult for everybody when you put out the list that says, oh, you can't transfer here, 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 here's where you can. It's not a good look for the school. It doesn't help the player. So I think that gets that out of the way, and that's just good. I think that's a solid move forward.
I think the one that really caught everyone's attention was Bo Ryan a few years ago when the transfer tried to get out of there, and he put down, 26 schools he couldn't go to?
Eventually
he ended up transferring to Iowa, and he had a great career. So,
yeah, I mean, that's just crazy, and that shouldn't happen. You know, and guys, some programs are good about it. You know, some programs will say, best of luck, we'll help you on your way out the door. Other programs aren't. And, you know, like we said with injury reports, make it uniform and make it consistent, and it's easier rules for everybody to follow. You'll see less rule breaking and tampering that way.
All right, you mentioned rules, Paul. Here's one that's a game rule, and that is the kickoff rule, where you can fair catch it inside the 25, and it's brought back, it's brought out to the 25-yard line as if it were a touchback. What was your thought when you saw that?
Well, you know, they put this new come out to the 25 rule in a few years back. It's been fine. I mean, it changed the game a little bit, but, you know, not noticeably different in my mind. One thing that teams started to try to do, and a lot of coaches, special teams coaches, would just work at it, was trying to get that lofty kick that would go up at the 2-yard line with enough hang time, or getting out to the 25 wasn't a sure thing or even close to a sure thing. I hate that they're removing the strategy from it, because I do think strategy and those kind of things are kind of what makes football more than just unique, kind of makes it bring some thinking into the game, and I'll miss that. But on the other hand, not to harp on it, we talk about player safety again. This is why they make these moves. That's the total impetus behind it. I hate that it removes the strategy, but I do sense and see where they're coming from. And again, we'll get used to it and we'll just kind of adapt, but it will be a noticeable difference, I think, for those first couple of weeks, certainly for fans tuning in and expecting a return from the 5 or something.
You know what, though, Paul? You and I are both around players. You put a running back, a receiver back there. He's the lone guy back there. He thinks he's going to make the play. I think we're going to see a handful of these, and it's probably going to be like an up guy that's a blocker. I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, it's a guess, but my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, running backs and receivers are the same way. They want the ball. So if they're going to, like, kick it to a guy at the 2, the idea that they're just going to be like, all right, let's take a knee or whatever, that doesn't make any sense, because guys are going to want to take a shot, because everyone thinks when they have the ball in their hand that they're about to score a touchdown. At the same time, I do think that teams are going to take advantage of it, you know, and I think that's going to be more about the kick that, you know, is along the sideline, or the one that, you know, kind of gets caught at the 12 with a lot of hang time and you just don't want to take the chance. You'll see a lot of those as people get more and more comfortable, but I would hate to see no one return it at all inside the 25. I mean, I hate the idea that would be removed entirely. I mean, that's too much.
I agree with you, but yet I look at the Alliance of American Football, the spring league that will start in February, and their rules include starting at the 25-yard line, no kickoff. In fact, I don't even think they have extra points. They'll have two-point conversions. Is there a thought
really
in your mind that down the road a few years from now that's the trend we'll see?
Yeah, I do. And, I mean, you're seeing it in incremental kind of steps and a process, but I do think we're headed in that direction where, you know, if this is how you start, where you're trying in a subtle way to cut down on kickoffs. The next step, obviously, is just to cut them down entirely. What's next, though? You know, I'm 100% all for making player safety the number one focus and concern for college football, because it's how you ensure
Absolutely.
That the game will definitely survive.
Mm-hmm.
But when do you stop? You know, this isn't about, like, defensive backs using their hands too much. Like, this is a rule change that kind of steps on top of each other and leads to one thing after another. I just don't know where you draw the line. And that being said, if you want to remove kickoffs, fine. But let's not dramatically or definitively change the game that we play, because that's kind of why we appreciate it.
Right. I see exactly where you're going with this. When the Supreme Court, I don't think it was a surprise. I knew New Jersey, you know, you and I both know New Jersey had lost it every step of the way, but for some reason I think the gut feeling was they were going to win at the Supreme Court level on a states' rights issue, which they did. When it finally did get the 5-4, I'm sorry, the 6-3 vote, what was your first thought about it?
Well, I mean, your first thought from my college sports perspective was just the profound impact this is going to have going forward. I think the NCAA has made anti-gambling, rightfully so, one of its hallmark messages. true student athletes, in addition to, you know, not cheating, no drugs, no gambling. It kind of fits into what the NCAA has been about in terms of their amateur model for decades. But this is a floodgate moment, you know, and there's too much money to be made in gambling for sports leagues and the NCAA to take a step back and say, well, go have at it. It's just not going to happen. So I think what you'll see, certainly in like the near future, as it becomes more and more prevalent, like we said, maybe the next 5 years, is, you know, you'll see championship events held in Las Vegas, and you'll see a championship event held in Delaware, where they removed them because of where Delaware stood on legalized sports gambling. And you'll see just an acceptance of it, that it's a way of life. I don't think you'll open up NCAA.com or NCAA.org and be taken to, oh, the NCAA has your lines and here's your gambling website. I don't think we'll go that far, but you're going to see a seismic change. And it's certainly seismic change in how we cover the sport, because it doesn't have to be whispered about for a lot of people. You can say it out loud, and for a lot of people, that Tua Tagovailoa, the quarterback for Alabama, hey, that's really important, but what do you think about -13.5? That's the big thing. So certainly will also change the way the media covers the sport. For better or worse, I think it will have an impact.
Have you thought in your own style about how you will or will not incorporate that into stories, or is it going to be on a case-by-case basis?
You know, I think for a lot of people, you got to sit back and think about every week doing something about it, you know, and writing about it, because like I said, it's an important part of the game. That's an important part of the game when you're not even, you know, in a work setting. You know, you're sitting at a bar with your friends, or, you know, in line at the grocery store. It's a conversation piece. So I do think it's an important thing for everybody to cover, because there is a national interest in it. Obviously you wouldn't pick the games, or I wouldn't pick on the games myself, because I'd lose, but also because it would be probably a little bit wrong. But I do think that, you know, you have to include it in your coverage, because it's what people are going to be talking about. The ability to do that is, again, I don't know if we can really explain it, just how big it is to be able to have this out in the open rather than, you know, just kind of on the tertiary or the outside of the game.
Yeah, because my thought process has been the guys that, and the men and women that have been gambling on games for years, whether it's Nevada or offshore, they're just going to keep doing what they've been doing. Now, maybe they'll do it in a state level as opposed to offshore. We'll see. But it's going to be, right, to me, the person that wants to go 10, 25, 50, 100, 500 on a game that hadn't done it before, didn't know how to do it, or avenue now can do it. I think that's going to be the difference maker. That, at least that's my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. It makes the casual person, it like opens it up to the casual person, you know, and the casual guy who thinks he knows who's going to beat the Yankees and the Blue Jays is going to throw a little down. Hey, you know, I can do it. I can go on the internet. I don't need to go to some strange, you know, Eastern European website to do this. I can just go on the internet and throw $500 down. So I think that is an opener for a lot of people. And I can't even imagine the money that's going to pour in. It's going to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars on sports gambling every year when this goes even past seven states. When it gets to 10 or 15, the money is going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, I think in 5 years is going to be 30 plus. But again, I don't go to strange European sites. I go usually to Europe today.
So I gave myself away. I don't either. I was trying to think, how could I say it? I don't want to be rude to any individual country, so I kind of made it generic. But you know what? And it's honest, I have never gambled on sports. That's predating I've never done it in my life. And I don't think I ever would, because I know how fickle this sport is and how impossible it is to bet. I mean, how can you really know if North Texas is going to lose to Georgia by more than 21 points? How could you know?
We don't. Now, I do teach a sports broadcasting class at Penn State on top of my other duties. And I've told them, I said, look, when it comes to gambling, do whatever you want. I've always told them that. Do whatever you want. I said, but don't gamble a dime on the game you're covering.
Yeah. Definitely don't do that, because there's a line there that you don't want to cross professionally. That would, I mean, because clearly, like, you're covering a game and it's -3 and they get a field goal in the final second and they win 17-13. I mean, that's not going to bleed into how you cover the game.
Right.
I mean, come on.
Right. I mean, it skews either way. Say they win, you're too euphoric about what you just saw, or if it goes the wrong way, you're too negative about what you saw.
Right. Don't do that. I would suggest to your students the same. And if they go to Penn State, they're already headed for greatness. Don't gamble on sports. Don't do that. That's just bad.
Hey, Paul, thanks so much. Have a great holiday. I really appreciate the fact you gave us time today. And on short notice, too. We really appreciate it.
I hope to talk to you again soon.